Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to season two of Ringside Rewind. We are up, we are off the canvas, we have dusted ourselves down and we are coming at you for season two. I'm joined, as always, by Ian Dark and John Rawling. Thanks for joining me, gents. And this week, we are going to look at the greatest heavyweights of all time. Ian, let's start with you. I mean, when you talk about great heavyweights, what's the criteria?
Yeah, that's a question, I think, before we start getting into the individual fighters. And there are some great names to talk about in this podcast. I think the first word is, you've got to have longevity, haven't you, to be a great. You've got to be around for a while. I think you've got to have been in some memorable fights that people talk about through the ages. You've got to have magnetism. You've got to have personality. You've got to have charisma as well. I don't think you can be a talented but largely unknown heavyweight and get into our top three, which I think we're going to do each of us at the end of the show today. So, yeah, I think those would be my very rough criteria.
John, how about you? I mean, it's hard to argue with that. Is there anything else that you add to the criteria?
I agree with what Ian said there about longevity. I mean, that's vital. But that's obviously married to the excitement that the fighters bring, their bravery, their will to win, power, technique. And yeah, as Ian said, it helps if they've been in great fights as well.
Yeah, I suppose the thing is, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? Because when you talk about greatness, you've got people who actually have defined not just their sporting or boxing era, but their times. You know, you've got people like Jack Dempsey, Joe Lewis and Muhammad Ali, which greatness extends outside of the sport as well, right, Ian?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think another problem we've got here as we go through this little puzzle that people love to do this, don't they, in the boxing beats around the world and the bars. We've all done this, had this argument. But of course, a lot of those names you just mentioned there, the old heavyweight stars, the Jack Dempseys, the Rocky Marcianos, I mean, they'd be cruiserweights today. So it's hard to make that comparison. But I think for the purposes of this exercise, we've got to kind of assume they were around the same weight and look at them at their peak. So, you know, okay, Lennox Lewis beat Mike Tyson, but it was way past Mike Tyson's best. That kind of thing, I think, has to weigh into our argument.
And of course, you know, modern training techniques, shall we call them, I think the ability to bulk up has become very much more pronounced than it would have been back in the 1920s and 1930s. And it's something which I always say, and I guess you guys would go along with it, all you can be is the best of your era. And if you dominate your era, as for instance Joe Lewis did, then clearly he comes into the equation.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
John, when you say bulk up, you said it very skeptically, as in we're in the PED era. And I suppose it is worth consideration in the sense that these guys weren't privy to such enhancements back in the day. And we have no idea who's on what and who's doing what these days. Certainly in recent times when you've had Dillian White have an adverse finding and then his replacement for Anthony Joshua, Robert Hellenius, also have an adverse finding. It's a rather gloomy picture. And that's even before we get back to the 80s heavyweights, where when you think of the dirtiest race in history, which I always often hark back to with Ben Johnson et al., you wonder what the boxers were on back then and have been ever since.
It's naive, isn't it, to think that the sport's clean, because again and again and again, it's shown not to be. And I think that it's the nature of athletes, fighters, or many of them, I suppose you shouldn't say all of them, but many of them, they'll push the boundaries as far as they think they can without getting caught.
So I think on a, you know, for want of getting sidetracked there, Ian, let's go back to simpler times. There was a time when Jack Johnson ruled the world, and obviously he was a pioneer. People thought that he was a great stylist. I mean, when you look back at when you look back on any footage of him now moving around, he probably was ahead of his time in many ways. I mean, there's some great Jack Johnson lines out there as well from what he meant in history, but he was one of the early greats.
He was, and I think you've got to put him in this conversation. I mean, none of us saw him box. We've only got that grainy old footage you were talking about, Chris. But, you know, this is a man really way ahead of his time, isn't he? He was a maverick. He fought pretty defensively, I think, from what I read and say. But he always seemed to win with something in hand. You know, I mean, and he had to fight vile racial hatred. I mean, when he won that fight against James J. Jeffries, there were riots across America. 20 people died in riots around all the American cities because they couldn't stand the idea of there being a black heavyweight champion. And there were loads of bets going on. I mean, it was a crazy, mad era where, you know, they came up with trumped up charges against him and all kinds of things. This is a guy who prevailed and really torchbearer in his time. And John said it, greatest heavyweight of your era. Well, Jack Johnson was clearly that, wasn't he? And, you know, he did it against that incredible social background, against all odds.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously he sparked what we now refer to as the search for the great white hope, in the sense that everyone was looking for a white fellow to knock him off. And they actually went down to middleweight to employ Stanley Ketchell to do it. And Ketchell was one of the all-time famous highlight reel knockout victims, in the sense that I think there was an unwritten rule between the two, between Johnson and Ketchell, that Johnson was going to go easy on Ketchell and carry him. And then Ketchell puts Jack Johnson down, and Johnson is, let's say, hacked off by it, jumps up to his feet, and then promptly embeds Ketchell's teeth in his glove as he knocks out half his bridge work and just about breaks his face and flattens poor Stanley, and that's it.
They were mates, weren't they, Tris? I mean, that was the story. Johnson and Ketchell were quite good mates.
Well, I'm not sure how the friendship stood after that. But yeah, John, it's hard to tell. I mean, from Jack Johnson, obviously, I suppose, you know, you don't want to, I suppose we're not going to be able to go through every lineal champion in history, but I suppose the next stop was Jack Dempsey in the Roaring Twenties.
Well, Dempsey was a phenomenally popular fighter, wasn't he? I mean, we see the grainy footage and the amazing photographs of vast, vast crowds who went to see him. And he had a fame which massively transcended sport. You know, he became a celebrity who remained famous. He had his restaurant on Broadway. And he remained famous until the day he died at the age of 87. He was one of the great iconic figures of American sports.
Yeah, I mean, he was box office, wasn't he? Dempsey, obviously. I mean, didn't they put on one of his fights in Shelby, Montana? A boxing backwater, if ever there was one. And apparently it just broke the town. And it was economically bankrupt for decades afterwards.
Yeah, so I think that was the Tommy Gibbons fight. But then obviously he had the thriller with Louis Thurpo, didn't he? There was the Carpentier $1 million gate, which I think John was referring to, one of those spectacular, you know, huge stadium shots we refer to.
And Gene Tunney, of course.
Well, I mean, I was going to come to Gene. There were the two fights with Tunney, including the long count fight. And I think, Dempsey left such an impression that I think Tunney had a bit of what Larry Holmes would have years later, where he didn't quite, you know, as good a fighter as he was, they were big shoes to fill for Gene Tunney, weren't they? Who was obviously the fighting Marine.
Yeah, well, that, you know, the long count, of course, you know, there's a sequel to that with the Buster Douglas, Mike Tyson, 1990, where they tried to rob Buster Douglas by saying, you know, the count had gone on too long. And, you know, I always remember that story at the press conference where Don King says, but don't worry, we're going to give Buster Douglas a rematch. And Eddie Schuyler, one of the great American reporters, put his hand up and said, what's on the undercard? Dempsey and Tunney again?
Yeah, I mean, Tunney was hugely underappreciated. I think I might be wrong, but I think his only loss was to Harry Greb, who he then beat several other times. And Greb was obviously a force of nature himself. And then I suppose we leap forward to Joe Lewis, who was just an incredible fighter.
I mean, just to fast forward it a little bit here, does anyone here think that Tyson Fury, just for modern young fans listening, does anybody think that Tyson Fury is in the top 10, say, all time? Here?
I think you need to wait for him to complete his body of work. He needs to get an Usyk and a Joshua on his record to cement a top 10. And either one or the other to possibly have an argument again on the top 10.
So you're not counting Francis Ngannou then?
I mean, it's astonishing it's even going to make it onto his record, isn't it? I mean, it's not even Floyd Patterson versus Pete Rademacher, who was obviously an Olympian making his debut, challenging Floyd Patterson back in the day. At least the guy was a boxer. And this is just...
Well, he won the big time, didn't he, Rademacher? But I mean, yeah, first pro fight. I mean, crazy that. But weird matches aren't anything new.
No, but also, I mean, the thing is, I'm not necessarily too mad at this fight, the Ngannou thing, even as a purist, because you can see from a business standpoint that apart from the biggest names in the heavyweight division, whether it's a Zhang, a Joshua, or an Usyk, there's probably no one else in the division, whether it's a Frank Sanchez, a Hergovich, that Fury could make this type of money with. And it's not come at the expense of one of those big fights, because none of them were on the table for this time of year anyway. So I don't know. I'm not mad about it. And it just doesn't bother me. It's a bit like the Misfits thing. It doesn't bother me because I don't cover it. It doesn't bother me.
I've got about as much interest in it as watching Bognor Regis Reserves play.
Well, I suppose, Ian, from your perspective, I mean, it's a bit like when the celebrities play football and the YouTubers play the celebrities or whatever it is. I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, for me as a boxing guy, I don't really, or even as a casual football fan who watches Premier League football, I've got no interest in watching people subpar kick football around as a neutral.
No, absolutely not. But I mean, we're in danger of sounding like dinosaurs, aren't we? Because there is a younger generation. I mean, this is a topic for another of our podcasts, I'm sure. So, but we can touch on it here, possibly, that, you know, maybe that is what, you know, the kids want to see these days. They want to see their YouTube stars, you know, in quotes and in big inverted commas, big fights. You know, it doesn't interest me at all. And I think the biggest argument against it is it's kind of unregulated, isn't it? This isn't like seniors golf, where somebody can go out and have a go, or pro celebrity golf. In boxing, you can get pretty badly hurt. And of course, the acid test of all of this phenomenon will be when somebody does get badly hurt. Because as I understand it, in Britain, the British Boxing Board of Control are not sanctioning these kind of matches. So they're going on kind of outside the circus tent, aren't they?
Well, at risk of taking it a little bit too seriously, I mean, obviously Ali fought Inoki back in the mid to late 70s in Japan, and he was obviously a wrestler. The thing is, the difference is that back then, people wanted to know what was better, whether it was what discipline it was, whether it was karate or taekwondo or wrestling or boxing. But now that debate has been proven. We know the boxers are better at boxing and the MMA guys are better at MMA, you know, depending on what the background is. Yeah. So we're not going to learn anything new. I suppose I'm going to have to put the asterisks on this and say, unless Ngannou lands that million to one shot. But it's highly, highly unlikely. Sorry, John, I just cut you off then.
I forgot where I was. I was enjoying it so much. No, I think the question was whether Tyson Fury was in the top 10, wasn't it? And I don't think he's done enough so far to be able to realistically make that claim. He's had three exciting fights against Deontay Wilder, remarkable fights in many ways. But you go beyond that and you've got Dillian White, you've got Derek Chisora. And
Klitschko.
Yeah. That's true. That's back in 2015. That was an interesting one, wasn't it? It wasn't a great fight, was it?
No, but it's an impressive victory to do it on the road over there. So I mean, can't discredit him for that. But it's an interesting one because it's not just applicable to Fury, but who of the current crop would you put in an all-time top 10, or does anyone have a claim, be it Wilder, Joshua, or Usyk?
Well, I think Usyk might soon come into the argument because he's got a fantastic skill set, hasn't he? You're right, and Fury might as well. They may edge into the argument, but I think you hit the nail on the head, Tris. We've got to wait to see the completed body of work.
Yeah, because...
And we might have to wait quite a long time as well.
Going back to the Ngannou thing, obviously, I got to Joe Lewis there where we had, in all due respect to Francis Ngannou, we had the bum of the month back in the Joe Lewis era.
Yeah.
And he proved it with his longevity. Obviously, he broke the record, had a long-time record for record defences for a heavyweight, even though I suppose it's interesting. A lot of his defences were subpar, weren't they, in terms of the opponents that were around in the day?
Yeah, he beat Max Baer and Schmeling, of course. You know, I mean, what a fight that must have been. The whole thing with the Nazi Germany one year before the Second World War starts, and you've got Joe Lewis fighting Schmeling, the hero of Germany at the time. So that was amazing. I mean, Braddock, Jesse Joe Walcott. So 25 defenses. He's got to be there. I mean, we spoke about longevity right at the start of all this. So that I think puts him right up there, doesn't it, as well? And John got it right. Of course, you can only beat and dominate the era that you're in. I mean, sad, wasn't it, really? That's one of the iconic boxing photographs, isn't it, of Joe Lewis spread-eagled through the rope by Rocky Marciano when he was broke and had to come back and try and do it for the money. But that's not the Joe Lewis I think anybody of that era would remember. He was a mighty fine operator with a devastating short left hook, among his many other attributes.
You remember the fights of the 30s more than when he was an old man. I mean, what was he, 36, 37, 38 or something when he fought Marciano? And he clearly shouldn't have had the fight. He did it for $300,000, and that was the end of his career. He was beaten so badly. But you know, you go back to the fight against Max Schmeling, who, remember, is the man who had beaten him earlier in his career. He'd inflicted a defeat on him, having watched him and saying, "I think I've spotted something." And my goodness, he did spot something, and he exploited it and he beat him. But it was built up. Arguably, that fight was. A big argument that it was one of the fights of the century, that 1938 rematch, for all the reasons that Ian's already given. And the radio commentary of that fight, when Schmeling got into trouble, the commentary back into Germany mysteriously got cut.
Your dog clearly agrees with your points, John.
I'm going to lock her out into the garden, I think.
She could become a star of this podcast. Keep her on.
Yeah, she's the fourth. She's the fourth Beatle. She's the member we didn't know that we needed.
Yeah.
She was getting excited because I was starting talking about a German. She's a German Shepherd, you see. So she's very much in the Schmeling camp.
Mm. Keep this going. We could get sponsorship from the RSPCA.
I mean, the Joe Lewis thing I find interesting because obviously he was pushed to the wire by Billy Conn as well, wasn't he, in their first fight, which was a tough fight until he finally broke through. It goes back to one of those things. You're only as good as your last fight, and he could always remedy it by knocking out someone else. And he obviously fought again with that bum of the month thing. He beat the likes of Tony Galento and all the characters from back in the day. I mean, there was a right assortment of characters in there.
Just imagine, I'm just thinking, Tris, as you're going through all of that, and John talking about the Max Schmeling sort of rematch in 1938, imagine what the pay-per-view revenue would have been today for a fight of that magnitude. I mean, I wonder whether there really has been any fight as big as that in history. I mean, hard for us to place ourselves back in the era, but just imagine what was going on around that with all the scenarios with Schmeling having won the first fight and beaten Joe Lewis. Now it's a rematch and the whole, you know, US v. Germany at the time. I mean, I think Schmeling later, didn't he get the Coca-Cola franchise for Hamburg or something given to him? And, you know, he was made forever with that.
Yeah. I mean,
interesting as well. He was made out to be the darling of Germany, of Nazi Germany, and he was anything but a Nazi. He was very much against the regime, as he proved later on during the war. He sheltered Jews in his hotel room in Berlin and helped them escape the Nazi regime. So to say he was any sort of pro-Hitler man couldn't have been more wrong. And it was another great thing about Schmeling, who's not going to come into our list as one of the great fighters, but I think he showed himself to be one of the great men, because when Joe Lewis got himself into financial difficulties, who helped him out? It was Max Schmeling. He gave him money. He helped to organize his funeral. He was a pallbearer when Joe Lewis died. And he showed himself to be a very remarkable man. Great friend of the Klitschkos as well, by the way.
Yeah. And talk about longevity. Schmeling lived to about 100 as well.
Yeah, not far off.
And then, so let's go from Joe Lewis to the man who unceremoniously dumped him in. You referred to that famous picture earlier, Rocky Marciano. I mean, in some ways, there was an air of the Dempsey about him, in the sense that he was tough, rugged, and he was a bit of a, I mean, maybe not the poster boy darling in terms of being the model good looks or the rogue good looks of a Dempsey. Because I don't think Marciano was in danger of hitting any catwalks in the 1940s, but he had that, I don't know, blue collar fame and blue collar following, didn't he? I mean, people loved Rocky because what you saw is what you got.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible, really. You have to talk about him in this conversation because he retired unbeaten, 49-0. he was just a bulldozer. Tough man. I mean, he got hit a lot. He was derided, I think, by a lot of the columnists, wasn't he, on his way through, as like crude. He probably still is probably quite disrespected, but again, became massive box office, didn't he? But are we going to put him in our top five? I would think probably not, are we? But even though he had that record, and even though he did beat a very faded Joe Lewis and Ezard Charles and Archie Moore, that kind of
I think he'd get into a lot of top tens, Marciano. I do. Yeah. It was obviously a very different time. And he, you know, like you said at the start, he was not a big man by any stretch of the imagination. His face could bust up and all the rest of it. But I always remember watching one video of Customato, the great trainer, who actually was so high on how big or how good Rocky Marciano's jab was. He says one of the most underappreciated weapons in boxing history, in the sense it was just such a battering ram that it didn't allow any of these people to really get footholds in the fight against him. Of people who might be able to outbox him, they couldn't get past his jab just banging in their face all the time, let alone his volume and his intensity for the rest of the fight. And the fact that, you know, a lot of his fights finished with knockouts, but they weren't necessarily all early at all. He carried his power late and chinned a lot of these guys as they flagged down the home stretch.
Yeah.
John, were you 40. A Marciano fan?
Not particularly, no. I mean, you appreciate his results and you appreciate the way in which he did bludgeon his way through. But I remember when I was a little boy and watching a youthful Muhammad Ali. Do you remember that? Ian might remember this. There was a computer-generated fight between the two of them, Ali Marciano. And it was a big talking point at the time. You know, we might say now, would Ali have beaten Mike Tyson? How would he have got on against Tyson Fury, etc., etc., and Lennox Lewis, of course? But at the time, there was a real sort of debate about who was the better between Marciano and Muhammad Ali.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you know, just going on from that, I mentioned that Gene Tunney struggled in the aftermath of Jack Dempsey the same way Holmes struggled in the aftermath of Ali. I think Ezard Charles struggled picking up the baton after Marciano, but he did, and then that led us into this era where there was Floyd Patterson, Ingemar Johansson, and then Patterson and Johansson traded the belt. I think they had three times and fought three times, but then beyond any shadow of a doubt, this big shadowy figure arrived from Denver or Philadelphia, should I say, or depending on where he was at the time, but Sonny Liston, who was one of the meanest, baddest, most intimidating heavyweights of all time. And he couldn't half fight as well, right, Ian?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you're coming in now. We've managed to go this far, I think. We're talking about fighters we actually never saw at all. But I mean, yeah, I remember all this when I was a young boy, and Ingemar Johansson knocked out Patterson. Isn't that when he drove back through the night from Chicago to New York, and he was so ashamed of losing the title? I remember interviewing Floyd Patterson. He came to London a lot later on, and he said, "You know what? The fight I learned the most from in my whole career was the first defeat against Joey Maxim." So I think he was a fascinating character. But sorry, yeah, you were asking about Sonny Liston. Well, he had a different type of career, didn't he? People were frightened of him. He was the bad man, evil. But what a jab he had! I mean, talk about underrated fighters. Sonny Liston, because he'll always be remembered for what happened in the two fights with, well, Cassius Clay, as it then was.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to look beyond those huge fights with Cassius. I think he was Clay for the first one and Ali for the second. I think it was right in the midst of the change. But yeah.
Right. Yeah, good. When he won the title, didn't he? The day after. Yeah, you're right.
The first one, though, John, I mean, let's start with that. And by the way, Ian, I think you were about to say that Floyd was so ashamed in that loss to Sonny Liston, that quick loss, that he actually left the arena in a disguise that night, didn't he?
That's it, yeah. Yeah.
And then he, you know, Floyd was a brave dude, though, because he took the challenge again, and exactly the same thing happened again, cleaned out in one round.
I remember when he fought Clay, as it was. I can remember people thinking that Clay was just gobby, flashy, and had no real substance. And a lot of people within the boxing world thought that Sonny Liston was just going to be too much for him. You know, as you say, he was this intimidating figure, and he clearly disliked Clay big time. He got it under his skin. And I think a lot of people thought that he was going to get badly hurt in that fight, because he was only a lad, you know, against this proven teak tough, intimidating figure who'd come through some spectacular wins. And the first fight really was remarkable, because Liston actually started okay, but it was just the speed of Ali, the speed and the belief. And even when he got something put on his gloves, Liston, and it got into Clay's eyes, Ali's eyes, and he was talking about not wanting to continue. Even then, as soon as his eyes cleared and he was back in control of the fight, he totally, totally dispirited Liston to the extent that it was the classic case, I think, of the bully who couldn't take it when it was coming back.
7-1 underdog he was. I remember on the build-up to that fight, the radio broadcast was saying this fight could be off because Clay was acting like a complete lunatic at the weigh-in before the fight. So they were worried about his mental health, whether he was scared and acting that way because he was so intimidated about what was going to happen. But it turned out to be all an act, like a lot of the things that Clay did. I mean, it was a sensation what happened. I don't think anybody could believe it. We woke up in the morning. In those days, there wasn't live coverage in the middle of the night. I mean, I don't know. It might have been closed circuit somewhere. I was too young to ever get anywhere near that. I switched on my radio in the morning and everybody, you know, I remember my mum saying, you know, Cassius Clay won. Cassius Clay won the fight. I'm like, no, he can't have done. What happened? It's like, It was that big a story when he won. And, of course, everybody knew him because we'd watched him on Saturday lunchtimes on BBC One Grandstand, they used to do like Fight of the Week with Don Dunphy on the commentary. And so all of Clay's early fights where he'd predict what round he was going to win in and then do it were on TV, mainstream TV. So a lot of people knew him before he became world champion. And yeah, it was everybody kind of loved him as well and thought, well, he's a great personality. And in return, I think he always loved British fight reporters and British fans.
We knew him as well through him having fought Henry, didn't we? We had the fight against Henry Cooper before the Liston fight. So, of course, the fact that he'd come over and beaten our Henry famously, that was that made us again know him all the more. But I think people did think that Liston was something else. And it was an extraordinary upset when he won, and then of course won the rematch as well.
Yeah, yes. I mean, he was, like you said, he was fighting blind for a round in that fight with the stuff that came off Liston's gloves apparently and into his eyes. And didn't he tell Angelo Dundee in the corner, "Rip the gloves off"? And yeah. Angelo said, "This is the championship. I'm not ripping the gloves off. Now get through it." And he did somehow. But I mean, yeah, the course of heavyweight history could have changed right there in the Liston fight. It could have changed, of course, had the bell not rung to end the round when, you know, he was knocked senseless by Henry Cooper's left foot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because the specter of the mob hung over Sonny Liston, because obviously he was a mobbed up fighter who was in trouble with the law throughout his life, not just his career. And so therefore the two Ali wins over Sonny Liston, the one where, because in the first fight, yes, Ali bravely fought through the liniment in the eyes as it was supposed to be. But then Sonny sat it out with a bad shoulder, didn't he? And he was, you know, people say that he quit that night when Ali obviously fought through adversity. And then the second fight, obviously we're going now into folklore territory with the phantom punch, was, you know, didn't he land that famous chopping right hand against Sonny Liston, who had, you know, been such a brute and taken massive shots and boxed with a broken jaw against, I think, Leotis Martin and other people. He took this wispy looking right hand that some people swear blind was the sort of shot that can turn your lights out, but other people just say not on your life would that have put over a Sonny Liston type figure. Ian, I mean, we can talk about this until the cows come home, couldn't we?
Yeah, we could. I mean, I always remember this happened many, many times. We'd go out for a meal before big fights, and it would always be an argument between Peter Moss, who used to write for the Daily Mail back in the day, and Colin Hart, bless him, from the Sun. And Colin always thought it was a phantom punch, and Peter Moss claimed to have seen this great shot that ended the second Ali Liston fight. This would go on half the evening, and sometimes it had almost come to blows. it never went anywhere. It's one of those, like, you know, the arguments about who won the Hagler Leonard fight. This goes on and on.
Yeah, I mean, John, it's a tough one for Ali, because, you know, when people reel off Ali's best wins, this should be right up there with it. But obviously there's just an asterisk over it again, isn't there? Historical asterisk. Both of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, it looked for all the world as though Liston took a dive for whatever reason. I'd be in Hartie's camp with that one. I'm afraid I'd have been arguing against Peter Moss, because there was just nothing on the punch, was there? Nothing. But he moved on from there, and but he kind of came on the road, didn't he? Because of the Muhammad Ali business and the association with Malcolm X and the Black Muslims, he became something of a pariah in the United States. So his best performances, some of them were over in the UK. And you look at some of the fights that followed in the 60s. You know, I always remember the Cleveland Williams fight. I thought he was absolutely stunning in that one.
He would have beaten any heavyweight any night in history, I think, fighting like that with the speed of a middleweight, this pinpoint precision surgeon accuracy. He was absolutely phenomenal. in that fight.
When you talk about longevity, obviously Ali is in a league of his own in the sense that he's, well, not really in a league of his own. I suppose you could factor George Foreman into this. We'll come to that. In the sense that he had two careers, one as Cassius Clay and one as Muhammad Ali. And he was a different fighter, a bit like Big George was, for in both incarnations. But that Cleveland Williams one was peak Cassius Clay. And like you said, Ian, it was just ferocious. I remember watching that fight for the first time on tape. And I didn't know what the result was, what the outcome was, and that it was such a an iconic fight for Ali later at his absolute best. I remember watching it thinking, this was just punch perfect. I mean, Williams couldn't hit him, and Clay couldn't miss. It was Calzaghe Lacey in about four rounds. It was just incredible, absolutely incredible stuff. And if anyone hasn't seen it, if you want to see what brilliance looks like, then go and watch that. I mean, people will say, oh yeah, Cleveland Williams wasn't the same fighter he'd been shot by a cop and it slowed down and all the rest of it. But take that out of the equation. Watch the fight for what it is. And it's punch perfect from Ali.
You've got to put him. I mean, we'll get to it at the end of the program. But if you want to tick all those boxes I spoke about at the beginning, longevity, great fights, magnetism, charisma. Of course, Muhammad Ali ticks all those boxes. He was voted on that BBC poll, the greatest sportsman of the 20th century. He was transcended the sport, recognized all over the world. So he was a gift, really, to the sport of boxing. So he called himself the greatest, and there aren't too many people, I think, who would argue.
John, who was better, Ali or Clay?
They were two different fighters, as you've said. I mean, I loved the way he fought before his time away from boxing. When he came back, it was about finding out that he had a different skill set. It was about bravery, ability to withstand attacks, and to tactically find a way of winning fights. You know, the night he beats George Foreman was absolute magic, but it's inconceivable that the Ali of 1966 would have taken the sort of onslaught that Foreman launched on him before he finally turned it round and won so memorably by stoppage. He was a very, very different fighter, and quite definitely he went on too long. We know that, you know, fights against the likes of Ernie Shavers, Spinks, Holmes, of course, they simply shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, but I mean, he carried that, didn't he? He carried that through those two different fighters, and he slowed up a bit, so he had to fight differently. Like you said, he was so tactically clever. His chin was so brilliant, and he still could think on his feet so wonderfully. But he still had that kind of magic miracle man feel. I mean, what he did with, you know, when he beat Liston against all the odds, he repeated that with Foreman. Everybody said, he can't win. He can't beat this guy who's demolished Joe Frazier. That's not going to happen. But he did. You know, I mean, Harry Carpenter's great commentary, you know, is one of the great boxing commentary lines, isn't it? Oh, my God, he's won the world title back at 32. And he's doing shuffle. You know, it's great stuff.
His detractors, Zoe, and if you're going to make an argument elsewhere for the likes of, you know, the likes of Tyson, of Lennox, of some of the other dominant fighters of the last half century, you know, his detractors would point to the fights against Ken Norton, and Norton was no world beater. He was a good fighter, a solid fighter, and a tough man. But there are a pretty persuasive argument. If you look at those fights closely, there's an argument that Ken Norton won all three fights.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, they say there's a style to beat everybody, don't they?
Well, Norton was the one he couldn't cope with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
By the way, Ian, we mentioned these seismic nights with Schmeling and Lewis, and with Ali and Liston. I mean, how big was the night that people actually do call it the fight of the century, 1971, Madison Square Garden, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier? I think, for a lot of boxing fans, if they could have been at any one fight in boxing history, that's going to be very near the top of the list.
Absolutely is. I mean, it's funny. I remember standing outside doing a piece to camera at Madison Square Garden and saying, It was here on March 8th, 1971, you know, the fight of the century, Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali. So I'm live on the air, and this New Yorker guy is standing next to me as I'm talking, and he goes, "Do you hear what the limey said? He says it's a fight of the century. I saw better fights at the Garden than that." You know, he's shouting, but he's coming all through on my micro. And anyway, I'm digressing. But yeah.
I've got to pause this, guys. I'm sorry. I've got to pause. I've got to pause here.
Okay.
Where is it? Winnie, is she around at yours?
Yeah. It's because through a shout up the door, straight in.
Well, it's because I'm doing a podcast and she was making so much noise, I shut her out. Are you all right with her for a little while?
No, all right.
All right, I'll be around. I'll be around soon.
Oh, dear.
She's gone round to the farm next door and gone and found her way.
Well, John, the RSPCA have just rejected our podcast for sponsorship because you couldn't shut blown the dog out.
You've blown the RSPCA out.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we've got you, John. We're just saying that you've just lost us the sponsorship with the RSPCA for kicking the dog out. So, anyway, look, let me pick it up. I mean, that fight of the century was so spectacular, John, that some people say that actually Joe Frazier winning that fight was the best individual win from any heavyweight in boxing history.
Mm. He was extraordinary that night, wasn't he? One of the dream fights, I think. When I get through to the other side and you're looking at talking up fights, I'd have loved to have seen a peak Joe Frazier fights a 1986, 87, 88 Mike Tyson. What a battle that would have been. That would have been just the most extraordinary fight. But Frazier, I think because of what followed, being demolished by Foreman and being outboxed in the second one by Ali and then the thriller in Manila losing there, I think he kind of lost his position of stature within the sport. But on that night, in 1971, he was right up there, Joe Frazier, right up there.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there with that, John. Imagine facing Joe Frazier on that night. You get the feeling he just about might have beaten anybody, don't you? He wanted it that much. I mean, perpetual motion, like a threshing machine, just keep on walking forward, throwing punch after punch after punch. And in the end, you know, not even the great fighter that Muhammad Ali was could match that fire. Not that night.
Do you know who he wouldn't have beaten that night?
Go on.
George Foreman. When you talk about stars and fights, I mean, if anyone had the antidote for Frazier, it was George, wasn't it?
Well, apparently, Kingston, Jamaica, when he lifted him off his feet, that was extraordinary that night.
Was he flawed? Was it seven times he was flawed, Tris?
Yes, I mean they fought a couple of times, didn't they? And it was one way traffic every time, and you know Joe couldn't do anything to the point where Joe actually shaved his head, didn't he, to try and get an advantage, try and get into George Foreman's head a little bit.
Yeah,
but yeah, Foreman back then was a different kind of threshing machine, not the same volume, but just. He was just a blunt force object moving forwards behind a stiff jab and a long straight right hand. And of course, I mean, he was deemed a giant back then, John, but not at all by today's standards.
No, he was, I mean, George is, what, 6'3", 6'4"? He wasn't as tall as Lennox Lewis, but it was his power, wasn't it? I mean, he was a phenomenal puncher, Foreman. And that's the measure of Muhammad Ali's performance, that he withstood that extraordinary attack in the early rounds of that fight and turned it around. The famous rope-a-dope tactics, it was the day Ali got it right. But Foreman was a big, intimidating heavyweight. And I remember when he quit, I think everybody thought that was it. I don't think that we thought that we would ever see him again. But back he came and produced the most extraordinary run of performances, culminating in the victory over Michael Mora when he became heavyweight champion again at the age of 45.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. So he does enter the calculations, doesn't he? He was a great heavyweight. I mean, what an era that was as well. I mean, Foreman, Frazier, yeah, Ali, and a few others as well. To win the world heavyweight title at 45 years of age, a reinvented heavyweight, it was incredible, wasn't it?
I was there. The atmosphere in that arena was extraordinary that night. Because, you know, Foreman was everybody's favourite fighter at the time, particularly on the other side of the pond. He was immensely popular, and Michael Mora, bless him, was not the most lovable and articulate of champions. So he hadn't got too many friends in that arena that night. And then when Foreman uncorked the big shot and he put him down, the place went absolutely ballistic. The atmosphere that night when Foreman did it was extraordinary.
Yeah. By the way, John, I thought you were a little bit unkind, a little bit harsh on Ken Norton, by the way, who I thought was very useful. And obviously, his three fights with Ali were, well, I mean, he was known for breaking Ali's jaw, but then he went and had one of the great heavyweight fights with Larry Holmes, albeit came on the wrong end of a decision there. But we sort of transition there from the, well, Larry Holmes really takes the torch out from that Champions Forever clutch of heavyweights. And by the way, obviously, there are the likes of Jimmy Ellis, Jimmy Young, Ron Lyle, Joe Bugner, Chuck Wepner. God, it was a never-ending list, wasn't it, of heavyweights through the 70s. But between them, they all fought countless times. But it was Holmes who emerged from being Ali's sparring partner to being the class of the heavyweights through the early 80s. But he sort of did suffer in Ali's shadow, didn't he, Ian?
He did, yeah. I mean, it was a shame for him, really, because he was a top-class heavyweight. And I'd have him in my top three, actually. I think he was vastly underrated, Holmes, who'd take a lot of beating. I mean, that is the saddest fight I've ever seen, the one with him and Ali. But, you know, he didn't want to do it, as he said at the press conference afterwards, but he had to take care of business. And the fight should have been stopped in about third or fourth round. It went on for 10 rounds, which was, you know, it had people in the audience in tears, and I was pretty close to tears myself doing my report at the end of that. But Holmes was good, wasn't he? I think it was a 7-8 year run as champion.
At the beginning, we were talking about what makes a great heavyweight. You know, one of the things that a great heavyweight has to have is technique. And when you look at the history of heavyweights, I think there's a pretty powerful argument that Larry Holmes might have had the best jab of the lot.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And he was a very well-rounded fighter. Good defensively, great foot movement, good right uppercut, good variety. And the jab is one of the all-time great punches.
I remember being at a press conference with Larry Holmes, and he said, I'm not going to talk to you all. He said, you're going to have to put microphones in front of me. So one of these guys said to him, this was before the Ali fight, said to him, one of those dumb questions you get occasionally, goes, Larry, just how hard do you hit? He was in a really bad mood. He turned around, the guy goes, you put that microphone any closer, I'm going to show you.
So, by the way, guys, talking about guys who didn't get a fair shake, I was thinking about this earlier, knowing we were doing this show. Michael Spinks, defined by his loss to Mike Tyson, but so much better than that. He obviously beat Muhammad. He beat Larry Holmes twice and ended his long unbeaten record. Obviously, Holmes fired up that. A fired up Holmes actually said that Spinks couldn't. No, that said that Rocky Marciano couldn't hold his jock strap when he was talking about going for that undefeated record. And he fell short against Michael Spinks, who, you know, proved himself as a very worthy heavyweight. But the fact that he didn't carry on his career after being bombed out by Mike Tyson, we'll never really know how good a heavyweight he actually was. But I suggest he was a lot better than that loss to Tyson showed us he was that night.
But that night also encapsulated everything about Mike Tyson at that time, didn't he? We talked earlier about Sonny Liston being an intimidating fighter. The Mike Tyson of
between 1985-86 through to the Frank Bruno fight in 1989. I mean, his aura of intimidation was extraordinary. I can remember being at some of those fights, and he just seemed a really dangerous guy, and he seemed that little bit unhinged as well, which made him all the more frightening.
Yeah. I mean, there was a heat and electricity, wasn't there, about Mike Tyson. Every time he got in the ring, he was a force of nature. It was a reign of terror, if you want to use the cliches. But he seemed like that. And as we've said before, in early editions of this podcast, you know, he had a lot of opponents beaten before the first bell. Not Evander Holyfield, of course, who got into the ring against him and singing a song, as I remember, and quite threw Tyson. But it would be great to have seen Tyson at his best, as you said, in a fight with somebody like Joe Frazier. I mean, I wonder how long that might have lasted, that out and out conflagration.
Well, do you remember on Tyson's way up, they tried to get this, didn't they? They tried to get Tyson v. Frazier, but they got Marvis Frazier, and yeah, they tried to make Marvis more into Joe than Marvis was. Like, Marvis was a good amateur who had some big wins in the amateurs, but he was a boxer and a very different style to his dad. But by the time they came to fight Mike Tyson, they tried to change Marvis into a hooker and a puncher, and Tyson was an actual hooker, and you know, you don't hook with a hooker, as they say, and 30 seconds later Marvis was crumpled on the deck in one of Tyson's most glorious knockouts. I suppose the thing that counts against Tyson here, John, is when we look at longevity, he was a shooting star, wasn't he? Because really, you know, away, you know, 86 to 88, or maybe pushing at 89, he was a force of nature. But after that, it was basically a long, steady decline, despite a couple of wins over Bruce Seldon and Frank Bruno for portions of the world title.
Well, it was the spell in, it was his lifestyle, and the spell when he was in jail, which took it away from Tyson. But I think he'd already peaked, hadn't he? I mean, the defeat against Buster Douglas in 1990, you can't forget about that. Whatever was going on in his life at the time, an inspired Buster Douglas did a number on him, and can you put a Tyson into the, even a candidate for being the best of all time, when he was capable of losing in the manner that he did against Buster Douglas? And I mean, on his day, Mike Tyson was exceptional, but in the latter stages, and certainly by the time he fought, Lennox Lewis, he was so far past his best. That he was utterly a faded figure, and really he was just there was somebody at the time said, you know, hookers don't worry about who they're with, they just worry about the paycheck. And it kind of got a bit like that, didn't it? It was sad to see, really, when we saw just what a terrific fighter he was as a youngster.
Yeah, I mean, he fails the longevity test, basically, doesn't he? But simply, He certainly passes the magnetism box office test.
Let me ask you this, though. So the thing with Tyson, obviously, I don't think, apart from Michael Spinks, he probably doesn't have that one clear, definitive or defining victory. So does it count how you beat these people? If it's not who you beat, is it how you beat them? Because he absolutely banjoed a generation of heavyweights, from obviously a poor Larry Holmes, who was 38 at the time, to a Tony Tubbs, to whoever it was, pretty much.
Rudder. Yeah. I mean, Spinks,
highlight reel knockout.
You said Spinks had beaten Larry Holmes twice, so to knock him out in 91 seconds, as he did in Atlantic City that night, I think they call it the war on the shore or something like that. That was incredible. That was peak Mike Tyson. You couldn't answer him. It was volcanic qualities that he had about him. But like John said, you know, the candle burnt out pretty quickly for him. So that is against him in any of the arguments. But, you know, if you want to go back, and I reckon today's younger generation of fight fans, is any fighter you'd like to have been at ringside to watch? I bet quite a few of them would say Mike Tyson.
Yeah, true. John, so this led us into this era where we had the four of them, really, Holyfield, Lewis, Bowe, and Tyson. But then, again, there was a strong supporting arc of, God, Razor Ruddock, Mercer, Smoking Burt Cooper, if I'm going to pull a name out of nowhere, Tommy Morrison. There was a whole slew of decent level guys around in the 90s that were making their bones in the division. But those four stood out, Bowe, Tyson, Lewis, and Holyfield. Is there one that stood out through the 90s? I think obviously Lennox came on sort of 99 onwards. Through the 90s, who was the best, would you say, of that crop? Holyfield?
Interesting question, isn't it? I mean, Holyfield beaten twice by Bowe, but he'd go down as probably the bravest heavyweight I've ever seen, Evander Holyfield. Bowe was underrated technically for a big man who stood something like 6'4". He was a very good infighter, terrific uppercuts he was capable of throwing. But the fact for me, you can't have Riddick Bowe, I don't believe, at the pinnacle of the sport because he ducked fighting Lennox Lewis. They threw the belt in the trash can and said, we're not going to fight you. So Lennox became champion, having beaten Razor Ruddock. And the WBC said, well, in that case, you've thrown the belt in the trash can. You're the new champion. And that's how Lennox became champion. Bowe was terrific. He was a very good fighter, though, again, hugely indisciplined. His coach, Eddie Futch, said something like, well, you know, most people go out and buy a Ferrari or something when they become the world champion. He went out and built himself an ensuite kitchen in his house to the bedroom. So if he wakes up in the middle of the night, he could get up and make himself burger. I kid you not. That was Riddick Bowe. When you talk about indisciplined athletes, he was right up there.
Mm. He suffers, doesn't he? He didn't want to fight Lennox Lewis again, having lost to him in the Olympics. It was clear. I mean, he had that guy Rock Newman around him. Do you remember that, John? It was as plain as you know, night follows day. They just didn't want that fight and would do anything to avoid going in with Lennox again. So, to me, of that group, I mean, it was a fascinating era. And the 10th round, was it the 10th round of the Bowe Holyfield first fight in Las Vegas? That's one of the great rounds of modern heavyweight history, isn't it?
Phenomenal, that was. Phenomenal. Bowe from pillar to post. Remember that before Holyfield came back.
Holyfield was regarded before that as quite a boring cruiserweight with not much charisma and not much marquee value. But that night, even though he lost that fight, suddenly everybody thought, wow, what a warrior he is. Let's go and buy tickets to watch him. And, you know, the rest is history with the way he conquered Tyson and the way he kept coming back and became a utter favorite of boxing fans worldwide.
Yeah, be remiss not to mention that huge first fight with Mike Tyson when he floored Tyson and then stopped him in I think it was the 11th round. And then obviously we came to the bike fight, which was, you know, we've discussed on this podcast before, with shots ringing out and Darkie and Glenn McCrory hiding behind slot machines or whatever it was. Lennox really got his opportunity, didn't he, against Holyfield twice. And it took two opportunities because Lennox got shafted with a draw the first time. He put things right the second fight. And then we came into the Lennox era, didn't we, where he was pretty much untouchable. Not only did he finish cleaning out the old heavyweights from the 90s, but he made a start on the next crop with David Tuohy, Michael Grant and Vitali Klitschko.
Yeah, he was. I'm a big Lennox Lewis admirer. I think when you look back at his career, he was a very, very impressive heavyweight, and more often than not, he was classy in the way in which he behaved. And I think it's a great testament to the sort of fighter he was that now, at the age of 58, he's still as clear-eyed and lucid as he is, having had so many big fights against so many outstanding heavyweights. You know, he doesn't carry the damage of the game, does he? He's one who has not been badly affected by boxing. He's very much a success story.
Classy, dignified, stylish, knew exactly what he had to do to win, avenged his only couple of defeats against Oliver McCall and Haseem Rahman. Robbed in the first fight with Holyfield. He won that more clearly, though they called it a draw, than the second one, where they gave him the decision. I felt they felt they owed him the decision. So, you know, look back at him, and he was around a long time, even beat an up-and-coming Vitali Klitschko in his last fight, which was a rugged, kind of bloody affair in Los Angeles, remembering covering that, and then walked away from it all. But I think history judges him very, very well, Lennox. I think Lennox is right up there, really, in this little argument we're having here tonight.
He's right up there on my list, definitely.
By the way, that Klitschko fight was done at about a week or two's notice, wasn't it? When the Canadian Kirk Johnson fell out of bed.
Yeah, forgot that. Yeah, you're right.
So talking of the Klitschkos, obviously they took up the mantle from Lennox in many ways, and you know, we've touched upon Fury and the modern crew now, but I suppose the Klitschkos between them had a decade at the top, didn't they? One way, shape or form. You had the bludgeoning, brooding presence of Vitali, and then the rebuilt Emmanuel Stewart version of Klitschko, who jabbed, grabbed and generally knocked out everyone he fought. And it was it's hard to say if it was an unsatisfactory period for the heavyweight division, because they were filling out arenas in Germany, left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And then they created a cottage industry for themselves in the Ukraine and Germany. I mean, Ian, is it a fond period of recollection for you, the Klitschko dominance, or not really?
Not particularly. No, I just found it a little bit robotic and mechanical at times, really. It didn't have that kind of grab you like that Holyfield, Bo Lewis era, or obviously that the Foreman Ali type of time. So to answer your question, no, but were they very effective heavyweights? Yeah, of course they were. Are they in my top five list? No.
I think it's a measure of Emmanuel Stewart, isn't it? I mean, Lennox was, he hired Manny after being beaten by Oliver McCall. And remember, Manny had been with McCall, and he came in, worked with Lennox and made Lennox a very much better fighter. And he did likewise with Vladimir Klitschko. I think this is not about trainers, is it? But he was exceptional, Manny Stewart, and two of the finest heavyweights of our era covering the sport are forever indebted to him.
Yeah. So okay, well, where are we then, gents? Are we saying top threes? Is that what we're going with? Yeah. So
yeah, let's finish to our top. Yeah, we'll each do our top three. So who's going to go first? Yeah, we'll do a number three. Go on, we'll do it. Each do a number three, then each do a number two, and then each do a number one.
Perfect. Okay, so...
Go on, Triz, you go first. You go first.
Who's your three?
I'm going to go number three. I'm going with Lennox. Superb fighter, could really mix up. Underrated. You could possibly shoot... I don't know if you can really criticise his chin. He got caught by two wonder punches. The McCall one, he could argue that he could have carried on from, and the Rahman one, I mean, he just, for me, took the heavyweight championship for granted, which was a negative, because he didn't really train for Rahman in the first fight. Came in late into South Africa, had been filming Ocean's 11, was overweight and got put over and rectified it emphatically about 6 or 7 months later, and did what he should have done the first time. Lennox, longevity, and like you said, chinning the likes of Ruddock in what, about 92, 93, and just an amazing career. And let's not forget Seoul Olympic gold medal as well.
So you've got Lennox at three. I'm going Larry Holmes at number three, because he was in the shadow of Muhammad Ali, and I think had he come along at another time, he would have been lauded far more.
I was tempted at number three to go for, sort of Mike Tyson. But as we said, he's undone by the fact that he wasn't around long enough. And at risk of saying the same things, I've gone number three, Larry Holmes. I think he's underrated. I think he was an outstanding heavyweight. and he doesn't really get the credit that he deserves.
Joe Lewis kicks off my number two. I think we'll be quite similar here, but his longevity was up there, that huge win over Max Schmeling. And although he had a relatively barren landscape at the time, he had the tools to be competitive, and not just competitive, but to beat so many great fighters. A massive puncher, could do almost everything, and was just a phenomenal, phenomenal fighter.
Snap from me, Joe Lewis at number two. Yeah.
My number two, I'm going with Lennox Lewis, because Joe, good as he was, I just don't think that he was big enough. And I can't see that Joe Lewis would have beaten a 6'3", 6'4" heavyweight with the power and boxing ability of Lennox Lewis. And I certainly don't think he'd have beaten the man who I will ultimately name as my number one. And the interesting thing was as well, you know, would Larry Holmes have beaten or fought and matched a top-level Lennox Lewis?
Can't be assuming for the purposes of this exercise that the size thing doesn't quite come into it, because, you know, in this era, Joe Lewis, you assume, would have been a rather bigger heavyweight. But anyway, okay.
Well, I'm going for Lennox. I think Lennox would have beaten Joe.
Yeah, I've got Lennox at four, but we're not doing top four. Okay. And number one, go on, Trent.
It's got to be Ali. His record stands up to almost anyone in boxing history, right?
Yeah. It's got to be Muhammad Ali, isn't it? The greatest is the greatest in this podcast, I think. Unless John's got some big shot for us.
No. Muhammad Ali was my all-time boxing hero. He's kind of the reason I wound up doing the job I did. And he was just everything you wanted to see in a sportsman, in a heavyweight boxer. And he was so much more as well than just a sportsman. He absolutely transcended sport, didn't he?
By the way, before I let you guys go, I'll just put a couple out there as placeholders, and you can come up with one of your own. If you could have a heavyweight dream fight, who would you have? And I've got two here. Sonny Liston versus George Foreman and Jack Dempsey versus Rocky Marciano. I'd go for those two. You know, I'm sure there's probably better fights, but as mouthwatering 50-50s go, I'd like to see both of those.
I'll go Mark Tyson.
Sorry, Ian, you first. Who are you saying?
Rocky Marciano against Mike Tyson. There, that's just right off the top of my head.
Yep.
John? I'd go Mike Tyson against Joe Frazier. I think that would have been an absolutely extraordinary fight, and it's a shame that they were separated by time, I guess, because it would have been one which would have been absolutely mouth-watering.
We can't put these fights on. We'd have made a bit of money, wouldn't we?
They'd never get made. Guys, before I leave, I just wanted to say how sorry we were to hear about the death of our mutual friend, Colonel Bob Sheridan, one of the iconic voices of boxing. Ian, it was dreadful news, wasn't it? Particularly because we'd been working with Bob recently.
And it was fantastic to talk to him. He provided the soundtrack to so much of boxing history. He was a fantastic character. Always fun to be around when you went to cover big fights. Wonderful voice. His voice just said boxing, and he fought so very, very hard against, you know, illness. I think he detailed quite a lot of it when we had him on the podcast, and what a special occasion it was to have him on the podcast. So rest in peace, Colonel Bob. You'll be missed.
Absolutely. Go along with that. Loved his company. He was one of those people who made Las Vegas special, wasn't he? I can see him now. He'd be sitting at the same bar every night. He'd be the center of the great social atmosphere around the place. And if you were around Bob Sheridan, you certainly knew you knew all about him. And, you know, the entertainment, the night out, came to you. He was a terrific commentator, a great boxing figure, Runyon-esque, I suppose you could say, and he was extraordinary good fun to be around. And yeah, rest in peace, Bob.
Lovely stuff, gents. Well, look, it's been brilliant to be back together, to get the band back together. Thanks so much for your time, Ian and John, and we will be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.